The Guardian.
Over the past 10 years, Afghanistan has been one of the world's main recipients of foreign aid. A total of $57 billion has been spent in the country since the start of the US-led invasion in 2001. But has the money been well spent? What has it achieved? Advocates point to millions of children now getting an education and an economy which grew at a staggering 22% in 2009-10. But critics say aid strategies have been distorted by military objectives and have produced few sustainable results. They argue that Afghanistan's economy is now deeply dependent on aid, and that is likely to be scaled back significantly in the next few years. What will be left to show for the billions of aid, if anything? Let's hear one experience of the past decade from Fahim, a 31-year-old living in the northeast of Afghanistan.
I'm selling Russian car parts in the markets. We used to have lots of Russian cars in the past, and my business was thriving. Now we have far fewer Russian cars, as the Afghan National Army and National Police are using American vehicles. They don't need these spare parts, and my business is suffering. I don't have enough money to buy new parts, and I can't buy new parts until I sell these.
That was Fahim, an auto parts trader in the northeast of the country. In this podcast, we'll be focusing on aid and the Afghan economy. We'll look back at the impact of aid in Afghanistan over the last 10 years and ask what needs to be done to improve the chances of sustainable economic development. Joining me to debate these issues is John Bennett, Director of Oxford Development Consultants and author of a 2009 review of the programme in Afghanistan of the UK Department for International Development. Also in the studio is Eleanor Nicol, Senior Campaigner for Global Witness, a London-based group that has been campaigning on the future of Afghanistan's vast mineral deposits. And down the line from Edinburgh is Mervyn Lee, Executive Director for the international NGO Mercy Corps, which has been working in Afghanistan for almost 25 years. Welcome. Mervyn, you're just back from a visit to Helmand. Mercy Corps has done a lot of work in agriculture. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the issues you've been dealing with in the last 25 years?
Yes, I can. It's true to say we've been in Helmand for that time. We've been there with the Russians. We've been there with the Taliban. And as I like to say now, we're there with NATO and the Taliban. It's been a fairly bumpy journey, as you might imagine. But we've established really good connections and relationships with the local community there, which has allowed us to work through this time. We work entirely with Helmandi staff down there, very few expats. Expats come in and out. As you know, the security down there has been very variable, and the expats don't tend to stay there. So this is in the hands of Afghanis, and that's a good thing. And it also means that we have these very, very close local relationships which help us to work and get us through some sticky patches. We've really been working in the last few years in fairly basic agricultural programs, and they've been around things like agricultural infrastructure, so putting in irrigation, giving access to markets to farmers, putting in roads, improving their water supply sources, and getting them to local markets easier. And we're now shifting down there, and I think it's appropriate perhaps to start this off on a very positive note, because I was there last month, on the 19th of September, and that was the first phase, the first 3 month training phase of a new program we've got there called Invest.
Can I come back to that one, Mervyn?
Sure.
Because that's a fascinating story. I just wondered if you could expand a little more about the basic agricultural programs and the economic development. For listeners who are not familiar with the Afghan economy, what are we basically dealing with?
Well, we're dealing down there with a very rural area and a rural community whose livelihoods depend on agriculture. And so what we've been doing over the years is improving their prospects of actually not just being subsistence farmers, but actually being productive farmers. And by doing so, to get them to actually make some money out of their agriculture and not just feed their families. So by providing access to markets, by providing better agricultural methods, by providing better seeds, better quality, and by training them in better methods, plus putting in very, very important water irrigation, and making them actually more resilient to the shocks that come in a country like Afghanistan, shocks which are produced by drought and by weather, and by the vagaries of living in a very, very difficult environment. So we've also been looking at and have built in Helmand the second of two agricultural high schools. And these are high schools for, in this case, young men. The ages are about 18 to 22. We've not just done the building, but we've put in the curriculum and all the facilities necessary to train these young men to really become effective agricultural people and to be agricultural businessmen.
John, I'm going to bring you in at this point because I just wondered if you could give us a sense of overview. The one thing that I think many people are familiar with is that Afghanistan is a very regional country and there are enormous differences between the different parts of the country. Does that feed through into its economy as well?
One thing we should always remind ourselves is that a poor country like Afghanistan will have significant regional differences. And although Mervyn is quite correct in raising some of the issues in Helmand, we must remember that Helmand accounts for only about 3.5% of the population. It is also, interestingly, one of the richest areas of Afghanistan. So there would be, I suppose, some questions asked over the proportion of aid that has been channeled to Helmand, because on an even playing field, you wouldn't have that same proportion of aid being channeled to Helmand. You would be looking at other areas of the country which are much poorer. You know, a question we have to ask is, has there been a distortion, in a sense, in the portioning of aid throughout the country as a result of the war and as a result of the various interests, you know, from the various donors that have been
so
involved?
So can you explain a little bit about why other areas are poorer? What are the regional differences which explain?
Very difficult for me to go into the depths of why it is that certain areas are poorer than others, but let me say this, that the country topographically is very different, of course, in many areas. The further north you go, quite often the poorer it gets, particularly when you go to areas north of Badakhshan and those areas, which are up in the mountains. There are certainly areas like that which are almost untouched for hundreds of years. So we have to accept, just simply on the basis of geography and isolation, there are areas which are poorer than others. There's also the issue of constant drought, of course, in the country. It's a very dry country. And if you depend on rainfall for agriculture and you don't have the means of doing irrigation on any substantial scale, then you're going to be in trouble, particularly if you enter into drought periods. And there have been significant drought periods in the country over the last 10 years. So I think to depict a country like Afghanistan, you have to remember that it's a country that's sort of, in a sense, almost always on the edge in terms of climate, in terms of people's accessibility to markets, all this kind of thing. And of course, the war itself has made this worse because it's precisely market access which enables people to have, you know, the wealth that they can accumulate for their families. In some areas, it's flourished, in other areas, it hasn't.
Mervyn, one of the figures is that 85% of the population of Afghanistan depends on agriculture for a living.
Yes.
When you look back at what you've been able to do over the last 10 years, do you feel that the programs have been productive, that they've worked, that they've managed to increase the income level?
Let me just put the record straight a little bit. And I entirely agree with John. There is that perception that a lot of aid money, and perhaps particularly British aid, has gone into Helmand. We, as an agency, were very well aware of that. And actually now we do work in the north and the south and the east, and we're working across 13, 14 provinces at the moment. So I think we're in a more balanced position. As to how effective things have been, it would be easy to say that we spent so many millions of euros or pounds or dollars, and that we reached out to so many hundreds of thousands of people and did this and that. I think the reality is that in certain places, in certain areas, we have improved people's lives in quite traditional ways by giving them better access to technology in particular, and by better access to methodology and training them in agricultural methods which are more appropriate to production yield, by increasing their chances of actually getting a good crop in. But again, as John said, Afghanistan is a country which is very fragile in terms of its environment. It's very fragile in terms of the weather. It's very fragile in terms of being, you know, sort of deforestation, and you get landslides and you get tough conditions to grow in. But I think overall, and 25 years is a long time, but it's been 25 years in places where there's been conflict as well. Overall, people are better off through the type of aid that not just us, but colleague agencies have put in. I think it comes to a very different thing when we look at what the NATO forces and others have attempted over the last 10 years through their PRTs and that military-driven aid, which I think is a different story.
Before we get on to that, I just wondered if we could talk about the issue of opium production, because there have been efforts over the last 10 years to divert farmers from producing opium and try developing other forms of agricultural outputs. John, has this policy been effective?
The short answer is no. I always think of opium as being something a bit like trying to search out Al-Qaeda. It's very difficult because it's a moving target. The efforts towards crop substitution certainly have not been successful. And it's hardly surprising. I mean, this is a kind of crop which renders high yields for farmers. But probably the most important thing as far as a farmer is concerned is that he doesn't have to go to a marketplace to sell his opium. The market comes to him. In other words, he sells his poppies at the farm gate. And that's very important in an insecure area. You don't have to go to a marketplace to sell it. You don't have to get a truck. You don't have to go through various roadblocks, etc. Your customers come to you. And that makes it an extremely attractive crop for a farmer to grow. It's hand to mouth. It's cash in hand. That's the first thing. The second thing, of course, is to do with, again, with topography. I mean, it's to do with the fact that poppies grow easily in Afghanistan. And thirdly, of course, there is this protection, if you like, that comes not only from the Taliban. I mean, there is this myth that it's just, you know, opium is somehow connected to funding the Taliban, etc. But that's not entirely true. I mean, yes, the Taliban have derived some benefit from opium production. But at the same time, there are people in the government in Afghanistan who are gaining access to income drawn from opium.
Mervyn, recently Mercy Corps has been pursuing a new strategy, which you mentioned earlier about offering skills training. Can you explain a little bit about what that's about?
Yes, I can. And I just want to pick up again on what John said there. I think, again, I absolutely agree with his line. What was very interesting a couple of years ago, I think it was 2009, is that a lot of opium farmers turned to wheat because the wheat price, the global wheat price in the last couple of years has been very high. And that sort of tells us that these guys are market savvy. They are business people, and they realized they'd actually get a very good price for wheat that year, so they grew wheat. We've now got fair trade raisins in UK supermarkets through a facility program that we've been setting up there. And again, the farmers we're dealing with, the UK companies dealing with there, and I was with them in December last year with one of the directors, and he was asking them about setting the price for this year's crop. And he said they'd lost some crop last year through mildew, and there was a reason for that. He lost 25%, and he'd be, you know, it'd be difficult to raise the price from last year's price, but he could go up by about 5 or 10%. And, you know, after powwow, the farmers came back and said, we'll stay at last year's price because that's going to compensate you for the production loss. And I thought that was a remarkable thing. Again, it illustrates these people are savvy, and they are at the stage now where they're prepared to go to market to be proper businessmen. And that's what we're doing down in again, in Helmand, but to qualify that again, just to say it's not Helmand specific, we're also going to roll it out to four other provinces in 2012. Now, what we did was we went to the businesses in Helmand and we said, what do you need and how can we help you grow your businesses? And we discussed that with them, and we developed with them a program homing in on the skills and the training they needed. And we got the businessmen involved in designing the program, and indeed we got the business involved in instructing the program. And it's a 3-month vocational training program, which ranges from embroidery to carpentry to mending tractors to mending mobile phones to commuter skills, etc. And the first of those programs ended in September, and that's the one I referred to earlier. On the 19th of September, we had the graduation ceremony. When the program was announced, 7,000 applicants came forward. We had space for just under 1,000. And on the 19th of September, 920 graduates of that program received their certificates. And of those 920, nearly 50% now are in employment. And I think that's largely because, A, the local needs were identified by the local people, and the local people who needed these people were involved in the training. Now, we find that very encouraging. We're going to open other centres in Helmand, including one for women, which is quite challenging in Afghanistan. And then, as I said, we're going to roll that out into four other provinces, Kandahar, Kunduz, Balkh and Baghlan.
Right. I just want to shift it now to another dimension of this problem. John, you carried out a review of DFID's activity in Afghanistan in 2009, and you described how stabilisation has been high on the agenda and that UK aid and military interventions are closely allied through provincial reconstruction teams, or PRTs. What has been the outcome, the impact of this overlap of civil and military aims for development, John?
We have to remember that going back to 2001, we had a peacekeeping mission in Afghanistan, and it turned kinetic, which is one of their words, by the way. In other words, it turned to counterinsurgency around about the end of 2005, beginning of 2006. And the situation changed rather dramatically in terms of UK policy. We had a situation where now we were talking about a whole-of-government approach. In other words, marrying the aid programme with the foreign policy, with the Ministry of Defence. It wasn't only, incidentally, the UK. Canada has a stabilisation unit and they're involved as well. Various other countries also have had something similar to that kind of arrangement. But it does have implications, because what happens is that one or other of these partners is going to drive the agenda. And most certainly what happened in the UK's case was that the military agenda became to some extent dominant. That meant that the way in which you did aid in these areas changed. The nature of it changed because you were dependent on the clearing of areas through military means.
Mervyn, has this been a problem for you working in Helmand?
Well, it's a problem overall, I think. Yeah, sure, Helmand from the British Forces point of view. I wrote to Hilary Benn when he was Secretary of State for International Development in 2006, when ISAF was starting up and these PRTs were starting up, and suggested, because the reality is they were going to do something, that they had to have this role, this provincial reconstruction role, and suggested to him that the military could be best employed on what I'd call heavy engineering. They could drill deep bore wells, and they could put in, you know, mains water schemes, and they could help people with road access and things like that, and leave the community aid, the traditional community aid, the grassroots stuff, to people like ourselves. And the big mistake I think they made in so many ways was seeking quick impact. And development is not about quick impact. It takes time. It takes relationship building. It takes trust. And it takes you to the point where you can hand over to the community a sustainable program and sustainable work. And if you're doing it in the way that the PRTs have done it, in very short periods of time, typically turning over in 6 months, 9 months, you just don't get that. And you end up doing more harm than good.
I mean, the other problem, Mervyn, is that most of the aid is going through the central government in Kabul. And that's an approach which probably also impedes participatory, community, Afghan-led development. Is that right?
To put that another way around, to determine what people need, you have to ask the people. It must be an assessment of what the Afghanis need, what the local communities need. And so often in the last 10 years, it's been other people from outside saying, this is what's required, and imposing on them solutions which, frankly, they don't need and are not suitable for them.
One of our readers on the website was talking about, you know, does the money actually reach the people that need it? Or does the money just go to Kabul and stay in Kabul? John?
I think it's a bit of both, actually, but I would say that it's important what Mervyn says about asking the people. And interestingly, the British government didn't even get round to asking the people until about 2008. And it was only then that we had sort of fairly regular surveys. There were a few before then. There was the Asia Foundation did a few and this kind of thing. But then, of course, rather, I would say, not surprisingly, they were rather shocked by the answer that came back. And that was that, you know, it was a fairly muted response in terms of people's views of the foreign aid and indeed of the foreign intervention in Afghanistan. Most people said their primary concern was the security of their own family. If you could get the security right, then everything else would fall in line, was pretty much the answer that came back from most people. It's true, it's important that you ask the people, but it's also the way that you ask them. By the way, I'll just tell you a little story about that because of the lack of access to populations, in around 2006, 2007, the only way you could ask people what they thought in Helmand was for soldiers to carry clipboards around with them, and they were armed to the teeth and going down the marketplace and asking people whether they thought soldiering was a good idea in Helmand. And of course, you can imagine, you know, the average merchant saying, oh yes, of course we think the British Army is wonderful, thank you very much. I happened to witness that when I was in Helmand. It is a difficulty to be able to actually ask these questions in the first place.
But the money getting stuck in Kabul.
Okay, back to the money in Kabul. One of the main channels of money has been this World Bank Trust Fund, which was a major source of income. All donors have contributed to this, including the British government. And this is a trust fund that has enabled the government to pay its salaries, basically. The majority of the money has gone to that, but there's been other aspects as well. One of the biggest problems, of course, has been to actually enable this government to function correctly. You've got to get your budgets in line. In other words, the way in which you deal with designing budgets and dispersing money through ministries is something that also the international assistance tried to help with. And one of the issues here, and it's a perennial problem for our government, for the British government, as well as for other governments, and that is that if you build a government like this that you have actually installed in the first place, there is a question of legitimacy here. What you're actually doing, you could arguably be creating a problem by building up a government which itself was never democratically sort of elected. Now, arguably, of course, they had elections, but elections were almost skewed, in a sense, later on to the fact that there were very few alternatives to the government that was sitting in Kabul.
Mervyn, do you think the money's been getting through to the places where it's needed?
No, not overall. But there's been various mechanisms over the last few years to recognise that. Our own Department for International Development, for example, has been largely giving people like ourselves money direct and not going through the appropriate ministry, simply because the appropriate ministry, as John implied, was not actually technically capable, if you like, of managing funds and managing a budget and so forth, not to mention also the fact there's a lot of corruption around, and corruption is rife throughout the country.
Corruption is a good point to pick up for our next bit of the programme, because I wanted to talk now about the future, and corruption is clearly a major issue going forward. Afghanistan is at third bottom in the Transparency International's League of Corruption. I wondered, Eleanor, in your work at Global Witness, you're considering how Afghanistan might make use of its natural mineral resources. Presumably corruption is a big concern for you.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. Global Witness has worked around the world in countries such as Cambodia, Democratic Republic of Congo, Liberia, all of which are very rich in natural resources, but also what I suppose one would term fragile states, either conflict or post-conflict societies. And our experience of working there has seen corruption in the management of natural resources and more broadly throughout the society erode away the potential gains.
Can you give us some idea of what Afghanistan's got? There's been some discussion recently that this is the way forward and that Afghanistan can wean itself off international aid because it's got such rich resources.
Yes, I think that's fair to say. The Afghan government itself last year came out with announcements that it has up to $3 trillion worth of mineral and petroleum reserves, which is globally significant. This includes, amongst other things, some of the largest unexploited copper and iron ore deposits in the world. You also have significant petroleum reserves up in the north of the country, gold. It's been described as the Saudi Arabia of lithium, chromite, and it has some of the world's best quality gemstones, rubies and emeralds. On top of that, and this is perhaps linking back to Mervyn's work, the US Geological Service last month came up with announcements that Helmand Province itself has very large rare earth deposits. So you name it, it's got it.
What's your view, John, about how Afghanistan might be able to handle these riches as the international engagement begins to wind down in the next few years?
Well, the big issue is about accountability, of course. You know, natural resources, as we've shown in so many places in the world, are not necessarily the answer to an equitable distribution of that wealth. Here we have a country which, as we know, is one of the poorest in the world. Even if they invest in the extraction of valuable minerals, etc., the question then becomes whether the government is able or willing to distribute that wealth amongst a population. And the way things are at the moment, it doesn't look good, frankly. The levels of corruption have not decreased over the years. The levels of accountability and the structures of accountability within the government are still very weak. Mineral wealth could become a curse rather than a blessing, as has happened in other countries to some extent.
Mervyn, there is talk that as the international forces begin their withdrawal, that aid levels to Afghanistan will also begin to drop off. I wondered how you as an NGO are trying to plan for the future. How will your work and commitment in Afghanistan be affected by the decline of US and UK engagement?
Well, the talk in Afghanistan now, in the last two visits I've done, December last year and just recently, is very much about transition. And there's a real effort being made by the embassies to handle and manage this transition well and to involve people like ourselves in it so that we're not left out in the cold and dry after 2014. And I certainly think, and I can't speak for the Department for International Development, but I'm fairly confident that they're going to continue to support Afghanistan in a significant way beyond that point. But I think what is more important now is to address in a strategic way what we should all be doing about the future of Afghanistan. And the mineral discussion is very important. That is not going to go away. People know that's there, and there's going to be people who are going to want to get involved in that. I agree entirely, it's not going to necessarily mean that everybody is going to get a share of that wealth, but at least from now on we can try and influence that in the right direction. But at the same time, there has to be the fostering and the building up of private sector development, of agriculture and rural development, and of the type of business growth that we're attempting in Helmand and four other provinces. And I think also it's very important to look not just at internal markets in Afghanistan, but to give people options to external markets. Just over 30 years ago, before the Russians came in, Afghanistan was a very different country, and it was a very major exporter and renowned for things like dried fruits and nuts and raisins and stuff like that. And they could be there again because there is that know-how, but the problem is opening up the markets. And there's a need, for example, to get trade agreements with neighbouring countries like Pakistan, who take produce from Afghanistan now and use Afghani produce to grow their own businesses at the expense of Afghani producers, because there aren't the right transit trade agreements with Pakistan. There was one. It's another typical case. It was drawn up by US consultants, and neither the Afghan or the Pakistan government were involved in it.
One of our readers, Sam Pickens of the Aga Khan Development Network, asks, what sort of long-term development solutions can you identify? And I wonder, John, what you would pick out.
Well, I think I'd agree with Mervyn that agriculture is still obviously one of the prime sectors in Afghanistan. I mean, when you look at the rural distribution of people, you know, how to improve their current hand-to-mouth type of existence in producing stuff in fields, basically. It's no good putting all your money in natural resources, you know, mineral wealth, when that's a long way down the line. In terms of most people in Afghanistan, invest in basic things such as irrigation and improved seeds, all those kind of things which increase productivity in the field.
Eleanor, there's going to be a conference in Istanbul and Bonn discussing international strategies on Afghanistan in the coming years. What are the kind of measures that you will be pushing for to ensure that these natural resources do not lead to conflict and corruption?
Well, first and foremost, we want the extractive industries to be on the table and discussed as part of Afghanistan's future economic strategy at these conferences. We also want there to be an acknowledgement that simply promoting the development of these industries as fast as possible in order to fill in the transition funding gap isn't necessarily going to be a silver bullet for Afghanistan, and that in order to get these industries right from the outset, we need to be looking at integrating transparency and accountability mechanisms. And that's goes right along the value chain of resource extraction, from the way in which you hand out these resources to the way the contracts are developed themselves and how the industry is monitored, whether that's done by an independent evaluator or by the government.
Well, that's all for this week's Guardian Global Development podcast. For more ongoing coverage of Afghanistan's development issues, visit guardian.co.uk/global development. My thanks to John Bennett, Mervyn Lee and Eleanor Nicol. I'm Madeline Bunting, the researcher was Claire Provost and the producer was Lucy Lamble.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.